in constructive math, in Bishop-style analysis, there's this principle of God, right?
To clarify this, Bishop said classical mathematics is intuitionistic mathematics plus God, right? I mean, if I ask you the question, does Captain Ahab has a blue shirt? This question hasn't got a Boolean truth value, right? Because we are not told what the color of a shirt is.
In a week where we have a very, very special guest, I think I can announce him by now. Hello, everybody. We wanted to try something slightly different. As you see, we do not have a guest today, and we want to try out to have a weekly scheduling format, at least. So bi-weekly, we still have a guest, and bi-weekly, we wanted to try to have these short in-between discussions between Thorsten and me. Great. So for our first little experiment, I wanted to ask you about something that came up quite often. You use this metaphor of mathematics is like a narrative, like a story. Mm-hmm. And let's dive into that a little bit. Would you like to elaborate how you see the issue?
Yeah. So it's on the one hand, it's a reaction to this idea, Platonic idea, that mathematics is somehow real and it's there already and we are just discovering it. I don't buy this for a number of reasons. I mean, it seems to be clear to me that mathematics is sort of evolving. It's not one thing. It's something fluid, and it's a part of our cultural evolution, I would say. Yeah, and so hence, so this idea as a sort of, I think this idea, this Platonic idea, is related to the idea of God. I mean, okay, we may not believe in God as a person, but we live in a sort of replacement, like there is the mathematics as of a fundamental godlike principle permeating the world. And I don't, it's not something I feel is right, basically.
I mean, there are quite some interesting thoughts in there. I mean, first, mathematics as culture, I find this hugely interesting. And I think that the new AI technologies will force us to take this more serious, that math, there's the culture there. It's not about proving stuff only, or it's not like the natural sciences, but more like the humanities. And the other, you're doing constructive math. In constructive math, in Bishop-style analysis, there's this principle of God, right? If you have an all-knowing being, things mm-hmm. change, mm-hmm. and then you don't have this fluidness. But let me
clarify this. Bishop said classical mathematics is intuitionistic mathematics plus God, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what you're referring to.
But let me push a little bit to understand how much development you would see. Would you say there's like a historical contingency there? So could we imagine that math would have taken another path and then another theorem would be true, or is that too much?
I mean, other theorems may be proven and considered, right? I don't know. I mean, there are certain aspects of mathematics which are sort of unavoidable in a way. I mean, like prime numbers, I'm sure aliens know prime numbers. So, but does this mean that they are discovered or constructed still? You could say, but if these aliens also create the same concept, then the concept somehow was already there. And that's a fair point. And maybe there's this language of discover and construct, which isn't very clear. But I would say it's still constructed, or it's still sort of designed. And you find that often when there are solutions being looked for, they are convergent, but not because they are already there, but because this is just a sort of obvious solution. In a way, for example, if you look in biological evolution, the concept of a wing has been discovered again and again, yeah, or has been constructed and discovered. I now use the same language, has been designed again and again, right? But I would still say it's a design process. Otherwise, it's also very difficult to put a precise border there. I mean, at one point, it is so unavoidable that it's discovered, and at some point, it's sort of design. I mean, when I write my program, we had this joke with Connor McBride. We gave a program and we said we discovered this program on a toilet in Addis Ababa. It was an addition program. Yeah? And it's like, you're not discovering programs. You create them. Yeah. And so it's with math. And it's very difficult, I mean, to put a line at which point it's sort of unavoidable, hence discovery. And at one point, there's a real choice or lots of choices, and it's discovered. So I think, to me, yes, there are aspects of mathematics which are unavoidable, which will always be designed by convergent evolution, but I still would call this a construction, a sort of necessary construction, but not something which is always there in any sense.
Hey folks, sorry for this little break. Our first season was supported by the Akademie der Wissenschaften in Hamburg, but since this support ran out, we are now looking to crowdfund our little endeavor here. So if you want to chip in and feel particularly generous, feel free to go to buymeacoffee.com/aboutlogic and contribute whatever you would like to. Thanks for your support, and now back to the episode.
Thanks.
You know, that's interesting. And I mean, you don't like to talk about truth, but let's talk a moment about truth. Because, I mean, truth in a fiction, you have this example of the captain in Moby Dick, yeah. Whether he has a red shirt, or I'm not sure what's exactly the example.
Blue shirt.
Also. Blue shirt.
Captain Ahab, yeah.
And I mean, how would you spell this out in detail? So you would say It's not true that he has a red shirt. It's not true that he has a blue shirt.
No.
Or would you say?
No, I would. I mean, if I ask you the question, does Captain Ahab has a blue shirt? Then this question hasn't got a Boolean truth value, right? Because basically we are not told, right? Whether he is, as far as I know, I should maybe check this, but we are not told what the color of his shirt is. So it's something which could be this way or that way. It could be have blue shirts and maybe not blue shirts, yeah? So we just don't know. So we cannot assign it a sort of classical truth value. And that's a typical aspect of storytelling, that there are lots of possible interpretations. So a story is necessary, doesn't fix all the data, and certain things are open. So to me, mathematics is also kind of storytelling. I mean, it's a particular kind. I mean, there are different kinds of stories, right? There are criminal stories, there are science fiction, there are fantasy stories, and so on, and they all have different sort of rules. What is acceptable, right? For example, in a criminal story, something which would not be consistent with sort of naive laws of physics isn't really acceptable, or then it would be not a criminal story, but sort of science fiction, actually. Yeah. So there are certain rules of storytelling which are different in different genres. And the genre of mathematics also has got quite some rules, how we can tell stories, and in particular there is some the reasoning has to be sort of acceptable and understandable and reconstructable and so on, right? That's not an arbitrary, it's a particular genre of stories which are about mathematics. And one thing which I find where the storytelling idea is very clear is to explain intuitionistic logic. So we usually use what's called Kripke models, and I find Kripke models and Bethe models, they are not often very clear, very well explained, I think. So to me, these logics are really the logics of storytelling. So for example, if I'm in a story and if I say, if they come over this mountain, we will lose the war. Yeah. then in the moment we may not. It's a war story. I don't know why I'm going on to war stories, but anyway. But in the moment we don't know whether maybe the other army comes over this mountain or not, and we don't know whether we lose the war or not. And let's say we assume that the statement is correct. Yeah. Then as soon as we know that they come over this mountain, we also know that the war is lost, right? And that's exactly the Kripke explanation of implication. Yeah, if A, then B. If whenever in the future we know A, then we also know B. We may not know in the moment. We know neither. But this is typical for storytelling, right? If an implication refers to future states of the story. And I would go on and explain disjunction. So now disjunction isn't modeled very well in Kripke models, but in Bethe models. And people may know, Kripke models are actually categorically related to pre-sheaf models. And Bethe models are actually what's called sheaf models. So I'm not going into the details here. But in a Bethe model, you have this principle. Basically, if something is unavoidable, we know it already now, right? So if all possible future something happens, then you know it already now, right? And to continue with my war story, if you say something like, they come over this mountain or they come over the sea. Yeah, if you say this, then, and it's a true statement in the story, then it means that before the end of the story, we will find out one or the other, right? That's a good storytelling principle, that we don't keep questions open. Okay, that's maybe not universally accepted, but that's the idea. And this is exactly the explanation of disjunction in Bethe models. In Bethe models, you say, basically, if you have a cover of the current world, so which means that any path in the future will go over this cover, and something is true in all worlds of this cover, then it's already, or true, so it's forced, is known there, then it's already known now, right? And this, actually, this Bethe models, they give you a complete semantic for intuitionistic logic. So everything which is provable is true in all Bethe models and vice versa.
I mean, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but for me, the important aspect of your story about stories is the epistemic part of it. So, I mean, in your view on narratives, you have this epistemic element. You wouldn't say the shirt is either red or it isn't, but you really think there is no reality in a story world. And mm-hmm. I mean, this is also how you could think about stories, right? I'm talking about the Harry Potter universe, mm-hmm. and there is a matter of fact there, and that would be the more Platonic idea of stories, so to speak, mm-hmm. right? And but again, this notion of culture there does a lot of heavy lifting, because there are some things that you can do, other things that you can't do. Mm-hmm. You might have implicit assumptions in your definitions that only come out later. And there you can do some cheating, but not all, so to speak. So there's mm-hmm. a negotiation process there.
Depends how you interpret the word epistemic. I usually understand it as trying to model how people actually reason, and this also applies to sort of common sense reasoning, which I don't really want to do here. So for me, intuitionistic reasoning is the logic here is in idealization. It's not epistemic in the sense as how we actually think. It's how we explain our thinking, right? So logic is an attempt to make precise what reasoning is, reflection on reasoning, But for me, the distinction is between, I mean, maybe imprecise distinction, which are one thing you could call mathematical logic, which is a real, which is an idealization, not necessarily Platonic, but an idealization of how we reason. We are not really addressing how everyday reasoning is working. And to me, at least, epistemic attempts exactly this. But obviously, it depends what we mean.
I think this is a verbal dispute. I would call that bounded rationality. And an epistemic, mm-hmm. I would say you are closed under logical rules, for instance. Mm-hmm. You get that immediately. The moment you told me the Peano axioms, I epistemically already know Fermat's last theorem. Uh-huh. But that's different from discipline to discipline, I guess, how you phrase it.
Yes. So in a way, I think we had this discussion with Graham Priest, and there I wasn't completely happy with also him sort of throwing intuitionistic logic in one back with all these sort of philosophical logics, which are an alternative to the classical logic. Yeah. And this includes what I would call epistemic logics. I mean, like, for example, he says we can reason, we can deal with contradictions because people epistemically can deal with contradictions. Yeah. But to me, this is not something which in this idealized logic, mathematical logic, I don't want to have contradictions, right? I mean, that's a basic requirement. So that for me, I wouldn't, to me, I mean, so if we look in what logic are we using when we do mathematics, or when we do not just mathematics, when we do any science, especially computer science, then we want to be pure in a sense. We don't really want to rely on human fallacies, weaknesses, confusions, everyday thinking. We want to extract somehow what we really mean here, what is relevant for mathematical reasoning, and then, as I have explained, so this classical logic seems to be unsatisfactory. And there's an interesting connection here. I mean, because the word constructive logic can be understood in two ways, right? Constructive in the sense that we recognize that mathematical concepts are actually constructed, and constructive, but also in the sense that our reasoning is constructive in the precise sense, right? So these are two different meanings of the word constructive, which are somehow related. I mean, once I start with this understanding that logic is discovered, then I end up with a constructive logic where I actually be more explicit about what I construct. I mean, in the sense that if I say there exists something, then I can also name it and so on.
We had one question where we had this question of having like the operator in the fiction and how it relates to other logical connectives. Do you have a theory there, like the prime example, the shirt is red or it isn't? And then you could say in the fiction, the shirt is red or it isn't, but you cannot say it's red in the fiction or it Ibs, or whatever.
Okay, this was a question. Was inside the story, somebody could say the shirt is blue or it's not blue, right?
And yeah, exactly.
I'm not so sure, but let's say we accept it, then it's actually a story in a story, right? It's a second order story because we are now talking about the mental state of the people in the story, right? And this is a different level of the story as such, right? how it evolves, right? It's a question of what do the people in the story think about the story, yeah? And there actually, we most likely want to understand their epistemic state, right? Unless it's a story about mathematicians, right? I mean, then we would say, then we would actually see if somebody says, does Captain Garp has a blue shirt or not? Then people would maybe say, I don't know, you know, or yes, or
yeah,
maybe,
exactly.
Or
the logician
say, yeah, no, he has a red shirt. Or, I mean, it's not, the status is not very clear, right? I mean, but it is, we are now reasoning about reasoners, right? Not about the story as such, I would say.
Is there any other aspect you would love to talk about in this view of mathematics, or
maybe, I mean, to me, there is a historic aspect here, I think. Where mathematics is also influenced by culture, let's say, yeah, and for a long time. The main application of mathematics was physics engineering, right? And there you at least have this metaphor of there is this real world in which I build my machines and so on, so which is then reflected in physics and in mathematics, right? I mean, yeah, I built a machine, but the laws it follows, they are already there, they are given, right? So this suggests or a sort of Platonic view of mathematics. But now recently we're using computers and we construct programs and programs are sort of or software in general is clearly constructed. And so if the main application of mathematics now moves a bit from this real world applications to this software applications, this changes sort of how we do mathematics, that we think of mathematical developments as sort of like a bit like software, whereas previously we may have thought about them as taking place in this perfect real world, and so I think this leads to a sort of paradigm change.
Yeah, I mean, there's at least the sociological fact that I guess there's more intuitionistic and constructive math in computer science departments than in physics department. I mean, we had Urs here, who might be a counterexample. I mean,
yeah.
It's everywhere, not necessarily in every department. Well, at home.
Cool.
Okay, great. So I see we still have a lot of things to talk about. I like this math as culture topic. At some point, I would love to talk about topos theory and different models for intuitionistic math as some background information for the audience.
And
but
we,
yeah,
and
yeah.
We could also fix my ignorance about philosophy, and maybe you can tell us a bit more about Wittgenstein and Hegel and stuff like this.
Sure. Then we can switch next time. You can think about a question to ask me what was missing in the episode. But for now, let's see us all in a week where we have a very, very special guest. I think I can announce him by now. It's Dana Scott, Turing Prize awardee, so it did a lot for philosophy of set theory, computability theory, so one of the greats. And you all can support us by tuning in, by commenting, by contributing at Buy Me a Coffee, and we look forward to your comments. If you have wishes for this in-between filler episodes, if you need some background information on a topic, if we forgot to reply to a comment, feel free to do that here so that we have content in 2 weeks for another episode without a guest.
Can I also add something before you wave off? So one thing I wanted to say about Dana Scott, who I met many times when I still was a student and young postdoc, and I always liked to talk to him, but I also liked the fact that he always asked stupid questions, right? he was particularly cool about this. And I still remember, I don't want to give any name, somebody, some other well-known category statistician giving a presentation about something. And Dana was sitting there, and after a while, he got up and said, "I don't understand a word what you're talking about." I mean, I felt the same, but I didn't dare to say this, but he had.
Yeah, and so whenever you people don't understand a word what we are talking about, put it in the comments so that we can deliver some background information. Okay, great.
Okay, so
thanks for the discussion.
And thank you for running the show. Thank you for everybody for tuning in. And buy us a coffee, please. Yeah,
I have one, but still.
Oh, shit. Don't. You're starving. You're running out of coffee.
Exactly. We are 2 episodes before the budget is over. No. Then see you all.
Okay.
Looking forward. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.